Coming up on Boston Public Radio, CNN's John King kicks things off talking about the president's marketing of an economic plan and Obamacare. Is it too late? And we'll ask him how Liz Warren is seen on Capitol Hill, a crusader or naive newcomer. Then Brendan O'Connell joins us in studio. He's an artist. His subject? The people of Walmart. And don't worry, a day after yet another surreal press conference, we'll ask you whether Anthony Weiner could do in Boston what he's trying to do in New York City.
Yeah, we're going to ask Boston Globe editor Brian McGroy that same question. Plus, whether Boston is now the bad news capital of the world. Then an urban designer tells us about fantastic ideas for giving cities like Boston a new and exciting look. Stuff like transforming billboards into waterfalls. All that's next on Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH.
From a transmitter atop Great Blue Hill, this is WGBH, live, local talk, Boston Public Radio.
He's Jim Browdy. I am Marjorie Egan. You are listening to 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
Hey there, Marjorie.
Hey.
Joining us on the line a day late, but he had other business. We're thrilled to have him to go over the latest national headlines, and particularly those that affect us here in New England, is CNN's chief national correspondent and Dorchester's own John King. Good afternoon, John.
Good afternoon. Sorry I'm a day late. I was at a lunch yesterday with a very important former senator from Massachusetts.
Who would that be?
The Secretary of State had a few of us over to say hello. It was very nice of him.
Really? Wow. Did he mention how his wife is doing? Because we've not heard much about Teresa Hines since she went to the hospital in Nantucket and then came to the hospital in Boston.
You know, the lunch was off the record, but I'm sure the Secretary wouldn't mind me saying that he was very optimistic actually.
Good.
about his wife. He said that she's doing a lot better and but it was scary at the beginning, but they're quite optimistic now. And he was very grateful for all the thoughts and prayers and well wishes of people. And so the rest of the conversation I need to keep private. We could talk subjects generally if you wanted to, but I'm sure he would not mind me saying that he was very happy and optimistic about her progress and very grateful for all.
Well, you know, people have talked about John Kerry here in Massachusetts for years as kind of being a stiff. But I was really touched when he talked about Teresa Hines, and people made fun of, you know, Times 57, you know, the billionaire and all that. She's an older woman and all that. He was almost in tears talking about his wife, and I really found it heartening and moving, frankly.
He was very, there were just a handful of us invited to the lunch. It was a very nice thing for him to do, and he got very emotional talking about the first early days when they were scared. And he also, and I'll let me say this clearly, he and his staff were both incredibly complimentary, but both to the first medical care she received and also, you know, the help she's getting now at Spalding Rehab. He was just... He could not say enough about the quality of the people who were helping her, and he was so grateful.
I'm assuming my invitation was just lost in the mail. Let's leave it at that.
Okay. Well, moving on, John King. You know, Barack Obama, reacting to the Trayvon Martin, George Zimmerman case last week, gave another kind of moving speech about race in America, talking about he could have been Trayvon Martin 35 years ago. I'm wondering what the response, the buzz, the room, the gossip has been down in Washington. Has it been a totally partisan response or what?
No, actually, the part that received a partisan response is in those remarks. The president did talk briefly about taking a look at those, you know, stand your ground laws. And mm-hmm. So there was a little bit of gun control, if you will. And what was otherwise, I think, a deeply personal statement of him speaking as an African-American man. Yes, he's our president. Look, you know, having grown up in Boston in the days of busing, having watched the country go through this, looking at any of the polling data about the racial divide after the verdict, good for the president. There will be people who debate, should he have done it right away? Should he have done it at all? Here's a guy who clearly, as he digested this over the couple days after the verdict, decided, you know what? I'm thinking about something, and I think as president, I better go tell the American people what I'm thinking. And good for him. Good for him. We get caught up in too much partisan stuff all the time. This is our first African-American president. He does have a unique platform to talk about any issue, and this issue has been causing a lot of debate and a lot of divide in the country. And my view, good for him for coming forward and trying to personalize it because, you know, I'm a white American, right? You know, I've talked about this with my African-American friends. I was up in Boston this past weekend and talking to people I ran into up there about it. There's clearly a racial divide about it. And for the president to try to help a white American or a Hispanic American or Asian American who might not understand especially white Americans, who might not understand the perspective of black Americans when it comes to, you know, cops and robbers and law and order and being viewed suspiciously, are good for him.
Yeah, let me just add to that. I think also there were a lot of black Americans, forget the races you described, who were relieved he did it. There was a lot of frustration that he wasn't talking about what the experience of black men was like in this country. And when you heard Eric Holder talking about running as a prosecutor to a movie in Georgetown and the cops stopping him, and then Barack Obama said, this used to happen to me too, I think there was also an African-American audience that felt, you know, it's about time. So I agree with you.
I think you're right. I think you're right. If somebody with such a platform, you know, make those statements, I think, you know, it was very, very smart. And look, he's in a delicate spot because, you know, the Justice Department is looking at potential civil rights violations. So the administration might have to get involved in some way. So he has to be careful. But, you know, he's sometimes, I've said this before, sometimes I think he's overly cautious. But he was willing to set that aside and say, you know what, this is bubbling inside me and I think I have to say something to the American people. Good for him.
Well, you mentioned, let's put partisanship aside. Let's bring it back to the table for a second. Barack Obama.
Hey, man, that was too long. We were too long.
Far too long. Barack Obama is giving a series of speeches, including one today about the economy. We know that starting, I guess, about a week ago, there was an effort to resell Obamacare amidst some polls that are a little discouraging, I assume, for the administration of conservative and moderate Democrats moving away from support of Obamacare. The response I have on both these fronts is, isn't this a little late in the game to be selling an economic plan and the health care law to the American people? Shouldn't this have been done ages ago?
Well, they're going to have to keep selling the health care law because as it is implemented, even though they've delayed the, you know, individual mandate, the business mandate, they've delayed that. A lot of it is still going into effect. And let's even assume you're an Obamacare supporter, or let's even assume you're a critic of Obamacare. But in the end, in 2 years or 3 years, you're going to look back and say, wow, that actually made my life easier. It lowered, maybe it lowers your costs a little bit. Maybe it streamlines your care. Maybe it allows you access to some care you don't have today. That might be what you think 2 or 3 years from now. But next year, especially, you know, maybe you have to fill out new paperwork. Maybe you have to go through a new process. Maybe you've got to switch who you get your health care from now and go to one of these exchanges. In the long run, it might benefit you, but there's going to be minimal hassle for some, maybe medium to maximum, more hassle for others, disruptions. And anytime that happens, people get a little grumpy, especially about something so personal as their health care. Republicans are counting on this politically. I mean, I'm having a policy conversation. When you change something so big, you know, things, it's hard, and it's never perfect. Even with the best of intentions, it's never perfect. So there are going to be some hiccups and then some problems, without a doubt, when you change something so big on the policy side. And Republicans see that as a political opening to say, we told you so. This is why government should not be involved in this stuff. Turn out and, you know, vote for us in 2014. So the administration needs to talk about this, both from helping people understand it's not going to be perfect, but this is the implementation. If you have a problem, you know, go to this agency or call this number or go online and find this. On the economy, look, the president's approval rating is okay. It's not great. It's okay. The reason it's okay, even though we have, you know, the IRS controversy and some other controversies, is because people feel better about the economy. And any president is going to try to use that rising tide idea to go out and start talking about the economy. He's going to push the Republicans to do some things that, frankly, Jim and Marjorie, they're just not going to do. So part of this is to keep his own numbers up, and part of it is to start framing 2014. I hate to say it. I know it's July 2013, but we are full bore into the midterm election season.
Yeah, but John, the point I was trying to make, but let's just stay on Obamacare for a moment. Obviously, the administration knew that this delay of the employer mandate they were going to do, whether it's legal or not, put that aside for a minute. It seems to me, and maybe this is oversimplification, may also be wrong, is they try to sell the thing at the time that it's passed, and you almost don't hear a peep in between. And for people who are skillful enough to know how to get elected twice to the most powerful position in the world, it seems to me they have totally dropped the ball on selling the facts of this thing, at least facts according to them, of what this thing does and doesn't do. I mean, that New York Times article that came out last week talking about the dramatic cut in premiums for people buying individual policies, that was like that the buzz around that lasted for about a minute and a half.
I think you hit on a point that is a constant criticism of this administration. They did win two elections. They do have a very good political operations, but they seem to drop the ball when it comes to long-term communications in the sense that, you know, I go back to when he was quote-unquote leading from behind in Libya. Did the president ever really consistently explain what the American was trying to do there? Has he ever consistently explained to people what he's trying to do in Syria? Did he ever try to arc the Arab Spring and say, you know, it's, there are going to be bumps along the road, but here's our North Star. This is where we think, you know, this region and our policy in that region is going to be in 3 to 5 years. And then you could come back to healthcare and education policy and tax reform. He tends to put things out there and say, you know, here's my plan, and then sometimes disappear for a while.
Yeah, exactly.
And that's been, you know, and they think that sometimes they just think, you know, because we said it and because we're good, it will happen. And so that has been a constant criticism.
Oops.
That's Jonah. Jonah Frank just came walking into the room. It's okay. It's okay.
He'll be doing these in a couple of years, John.
Jonah disagrees with my criticism of the president or something, and he was coming to help with his Elmo hat on.
Yeah.
Hey, you know, John, you know, just on this note, you know what this reminded me of as you were speaking? Is there was a great, I'm sure you read this because you covered the presidential campaign in 88 with Michael Dukakis, obviously, and broke the news as a young AP reporter that his choice was Lloyd Benson. I remember that John King did. Is there was a book written by two Globe reporters, Who's Broad Stripes, about the campaign. And I'm a huge fan of Michael Dukakis, but I'll never forget John. What's his chief? Marjorie, what's his chief? John, you know, his chief.
Sasso.
John Sasso. Oh, yes.
And I get this mostly right. With 8 or 10 days to go, Dukakis apparently gives this great speech. I think in Dallas or something. I'm not sure. And Sasso says to Mike Dukakis, that was the best speech you've given the whole campaign. You're closing in on Bush. You got to give that speech again. And Dukakis's response almost verbatim was, why would I give it again? I gave it yesterday. And it's sort of, you know, but you assume with a master communicator like Obama and his team, you know, you mentioned Syria and other places like that. There, I think he was behind the curve because he didn't know what his position was. On Obamacare, he knows what he believes in. It's his law. And I just think he's late coming to the game. In any case, we can move on.
Well, the master of this, you know, look, repetitive, being redundant is one of the great skills, especially
yes.
in national politics. But for Dukakis, I think the problem was, you know, he had been the governor and everybody knew him, and he thought, well, I said that, so now everybody gets it. I think Obama has the same problem sometimes. It's a big country. People are really busy. They might not have seen that speech. A lot of people didn't see him when they walked into the briefing room and talked about Trayvon Martin. They only saw it because it got, you know, repeated
sure.
coverage over the weekend.
Yeah.
We're talking about it days later. Or now in the Twitterverse and, you know, Facebook and everything else. That's how a lot of people find out about these things. You know, remember, you know, Ronald Reagan was the master at this, and he was at that sort of the beginning of the cable age, never mind the internet and the Twitterverse and everything else, where you point to a North Star and you point to it repeatedly, and you say, that's where we're going. And, you know, there are still conservatives out there who think Ronald Reagan never raised taxes because he always talked about lower spending and less government and lower
Great
taxes.
Point.
He raised taxes 38 times between governor and president of the United States. I'm probably off a number or two, but somewhere in that ballpark, because he constantly laid out the big picture. And he
yeah.
left the details to others. And there's, Bill Clinton was good at this when he wanted to be. And, you know, George W. Bush, less so early on, post 9/11. I think Bush was brilliant at this, and then it disappeared in the partisanship over Iraq. This president, I think if it's a fair criticism, and his friends would tell you that he lays down his marker, and then sometimes he disappears yeah. for a while, and then he comes back, you know, in the final lap of the race when he's behind, and then said, oh, God, how are we going to catch up?
You know, you mentioned Bill Clinton. Barack Obama could not have said this about himself, but I thought Bill Clinton had the line in his speech at the convention that might have saved Barack Obama's rear end in the last reelection when he said that no president, given what Barack Obama faced coming into office, could have fixed things that fast. And that was somebody needed to say that. Bill Clinton did, and it gave a lot of the doubters reason to think, okay, I'll give this guy one more chance. But anyway, let's move on to our junior, well, she's the senior senator now, actually. Elizabeth Warren, Ed Markey is the junior senator. There's been this big brouhaha, John, you know, about these student loans. They doubled July 1st up to 6.8. They had been 3.4. So there's this compromise deal now in the Senate to give, instead of 3.4, 3.9 for undergraduates. Graduate students have to pay a little bit more. Elizabeth Warren, our senior senator, and Ed Markey, they are threatening to block this deal. The Globe this morning said that they should get with the program because it could be the best deal they're going to get. If they don't go along with this, this is probably the best deal we're going to get for these student loans, I would assume.
It's probably the best deal. Look, if they're saying they're going to block it to try to get people back into the room to try to knock out, you know, a point off and make it 3-6 instead of 3-9 or make it 3-7 instead of 3-9, that's how the process works. People, you know, we've talked about this in the past, Republicans blocking, you know, Obama says he wants to pass a resolution saying isn't sunrise great, and the Republicans block it just because. There's a lot of that in Washington. The old way you used your power in the Senate was if you know, to force them back into the room, to force another meeting. If that's what Elizabeth Warren and Ed Markey want to do, I'm not endorsing their position. I cover them. I don't pick sides. Good for them. Good for them. And if this will be done retroactively, so if that delays it for a couple of days and they get a meeting and either they get their way or at least they can walk out and say we tried, there's nothing wrong with that. If in the end, you know, this is the constant Democratic criticism of the Republicans is they don't know when to make a deal. They won't take a good deal. If in the end, you know, they're both smart people, Ed Markey and Elizabeth Warren, whether you agree or disagree with their policies. If in the end they sit in a room with other smart people and they say, sorry, here's the math. This is the best deal we can get. I assume they'll support it. If they're going to use their leverage in the meantime to try to make it a little better, that's their job.
Well, except even Dick Durbin, forget Republicans, Dick Durbin, the senior senator from Illinois, reportedly went over to Elizabeth Warren on the floor of the Senate and said something like, Elizabeth, you got to face reality here. So there's a lot of press locally. You have Alex Beam in the Globe calling her a, quote, feckless demagogue over the weekend. Others are calling her a crusader. But when you're new, it's one thing when you've been there for a while. How is she seen within the confines of Capitol Hill, where the conventional wisdom is you don't act like Ted Cruz from Texas and Elizabeth Warren, you sort of wait your turn? How is she viewed?
I'll give you two schools on this one. There was this woman named Hillary Clinton. She was very well known nationally. She became a senator from New York, and everyone thought she was just going to try to be a national politician on day one. Look, she wanted to be one on day 10 or 12, but she spent the first months in the Senate working on New York State issues and going to her subcommittee hearings and impressing everybody, including all the Republicans. Then there was this guy, Barack Obama, who came to Washington. He was apparently a United States senator. I don't think anyone ever saw him in the building because he was out running for president. And I'm exaggerating a little bit. Remember, when he was running for the nomination, he forgot what committees he was on because he was never really in the, you know, he's hardly in the United States Senate. So there are two ways to do this in recent history. And a lot of people think Elizabeth Warren, if Hillary doesn't run, is in the back of her mind thinking, maybe, just maybe. And so there's a lot of suspicion, and some of that's not fair, but welcome to national politics and welcome to the way things work. You know, she should be careful. It's a tough adjustment. She's never held elective office, so, you know, all of us should cut her a little bit of slack. But if her fellow Democrats, the people who are with her 99% of the time, start to think that she's an opportunist and not a team player, that will hurt her. That will hurt her, unless she has the gift, like that guy Senator Obama did. And then maybe she's Madam President or Madam Vice President, and we look back on this conversation and laugh at ourselves.
Yeah, they had a big piece of the Globe yesterday about how Ed Markey's like sort of in the background as Elizabeth's star power emerges at every stop she makes. But anyway, John,
he can help her a lot. His legislative skills, let's hope for the people in Massachusetts. Again, I'm not agreeing with their policies. Let's hope for the people in Massachusetts, given the fact that they have so little seniority, that those two forge a very good relationship. Because, you know, at least Markey was a chairman in the House. He knows how to make the sausage. He knows how to cut a deal. He knows how to legislate. And she has this, you know, she may have this bigger arc about, you know, defending the middle class and fighting the big banks. If they can combine the two of those things into something that's effective, they can learn from each other. But in the short term, in the early days, the junior senator can teach the senior senator about how the legislative process works.
We're talking to CNN's John King.
So, John, our weekly immigration question, what's happening?
You know, there's some progress in the House in the sense of doing the children, the dreamers, if you will, the children of illegal immigrants, the young kids who were brought over the border illegally, but, you know, too young to have any role in that decision, just carried by their parents, essentially. So the House is ready to do that. House Republicans are ready to do that. But you still have some statements from some Republicans like Steve King of Iowa that make your eyes roll back into your head and flip, even about those kids. And look, I can see two paths here. Number one, the House passes one or two things that get you into a conference committee, and then magic happens down the road and you get a big bill. It's possible. I think the more likely scenario is that the Republican House cannot muster enough votes for a path to citizenship. And so even if they stop short and say, we could give you a path to status, that the pressure on the president is too great. And he says, no, I want a full path to citizenship. And we go through this again in 2014 and maybe into 2016. And there are enough votes to get most of this stuff done. They agree on most of these things, but politics and demagoguery are getting in the way of it.
Okay, here is the last thing. We rarely give you a choice, John King. We usually run the agenda here, and you give us the updates on everything. You have a choice about which of the following two things you'd like to discuss first. One, a mayor on the West Coast who puts women in headlocks and talks about sex, or a would-be mayor in New York City who continues to sext young women after he leaves Congress. Do you want the mayor of San Diego, or do you want to start with the would-be mayor of New York City?
Can we put them both on a boat in the Mississippi River and leave them in the middle of the country? They're coastal guys. We take them to the middle of the country and just lose them both.
You know, I assume you know, I mean, the guy in San Diego was a congressman for, what, 20 years? Obviously, Anthony Weiner.
I've met Bob Filner. Yeah, I've met him a couple times.
Was a congressman. What do you these stories are almost Saturday Night Live worthy. What do you make
especially
of this?
Especially the mayor. He's 70. I mean, has he been, did he just start this in the last couple of years, or was he doing this at 30 and nobody knew?
I've said this before in other stories. You know, everybody out there listening who's a perfect person, raise your hand, right? And there aren't that many hands up because there are no perfect people. We all have our faults and our problems, and I have a long list of them on my own.
Yeah, I don't think he's put anyone in a headlock, John.
So you try to cut these guys some slack, and you try to say, okay, people make mistakes, and, you know, I believe in redemption, both from a spiritual standpoint and a political standpoint. I believe in redemption. However, I also believe in common sense and common courtesy. And they should have the common sense to deal with their problems in a quiet, private way. And they should have the common courtesy to not make the rest of us, especially the citizens of whether it's the city of San Diego or now the people of New York, have to live this every day. You know, if you can come forward and say, I had problems and I am completely cured, and you want to make that case, great. If you want to say, I resigned from Congress and, oh, now actually last summer he was still doing this, you know, I think he's got a problem. I think he's got a problem politically, but I think the bigger issue as a human being is he's got a problem personally. And he should, go away and deal with that.
You know, my dream, John King.
It's not group therapy. 8 million people in New York is not his group therapy session.
My dream, John King, is to see John King standing next to the magic wall, breaking it down precinct by precinct in the five boroughs on the mayoral race, where at least prior to yesterday, Anthony Weiner had a small lead, which to me is just surreal.
Yeah. Hey, John King, one last thing from me. Jim has no interest in any of this, but I have to tell you, I have been glued to CNN's coverage of the royal birth, the Kate and Will plus one. I've enjoyed every single solitary second. You've got your royal correspondents there. You've got people that are – I love that. Wouldn't you like to be the royal correspondent just for a day?
I think
it'd be kind of fun. Great job to you guys on Kate and Will plus one.
As the Duke of Dorchester, King John, the Duke of Dorchester, I'm offended I've been passed over again for the throne. But other than that, I admire our
Hey, I was the Prince of Cambridge before this kid was the Prince of Cambridge.
I haven't seen John on the Kate and Will Plus One series, but I've seen a lot of other people.
Hey, John King, it's a pleasure as always. We'll talk to you next Tuesday. Thanks so much for your time. John King from CNN.
He is CNN's chief national correspondent. As Jim said, he joins us every week. And up next... where we're going next? We're going to Walmart. We're going to talk to Brendan O'Connell, a painter, a fantastic painter, who finds his inspiration at that unlikely spot, Walmart. That conversation is next on Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. I am Jim Browdy. She is Marjorie Egan. In the U.S., one out of every $4 that we spend on groceries, we spend at Walmart. If you combine all the Walmart parking lots, you'd have a plot of land the size of Tampa, Florida, the most frequent destination that people type into their GPS. What do you think that is, Marjorie?
Walmart.
That's right. Walmart is also the place where painter Brendan O'Connell goes to work, not to check out customers that greet him, but to capture on canvas the je ne sais quoi of the big box store. This afternoon, Brendan will be painting at the Walmart in Lynn, but first he joins us here in Studio 3. Brendan, it's a pleasure to meet you.
Hi.
It is an absolute pleasure to meet you.
Hi.
And I find this absolutely an amazing story. Tell people, if they didn't see the front page of the Globe today and your beautiful picture right on the front page of the Boston Globe, what exactly you are doing in these Walmart stores, please, Brendan.
Well, today and yesterday, I'll be painting in Quincy Walmart, not Lynn.
Oh, sorry. My apologies.
And I was painting there yesterday, but I kind of went from being the guy who got thrown out of Walmart for taking pictures of a cashier to now I can set up on
Walmart loves
aisle.
You. Let's go back. Before we talk current events, Brendan, let's go back in time. What was the inspiration for this? How did you decide that we knew, Marjorie and I in our former radio lives, used to go to peopleofwalmart.com, which have these incredible photographs.
It was not a polite site.
But then all of a sudden I heard about you maybe 2 or 3 years ago. How did it get started with you? How did you start doing this?
Well, I was doing paintings about everyday life, everyday America, and I would have people getting dressed, brushing their teeth or just everyday activities. And someone suggested that I follow someone out into the day and watch them, photograph them, and make paintings of that. And the first outing was a Walmart, and I thought this was a pretty captivating environment.
Had you ever been in one before?
Oh yeah.
I grew up in the South. Where'd you grow up?
Yeah, Atlanta.
You don't sound like it.
St. Augustine, Florida.
But you know, before that though, I read where you were going to be a writer. You get out of college, go home, live with your mom and dad. You're going to be a writer. Then you go to Paris and find all the writers are miserable.
Right. Writers tend to be less happy than painters. Uh-huh. I don't know why.
And so after not having any formal training, you started to – I mean, you're a pretty damn good painter for someone that didn't have much formal training.
I started painting when I was 22. I taught myself to draw. I didn't think I was an artist as a child because I didn't know how to draw.
Uh-huh.
And once I learned how to draw, I kind of – that's – partly why I'm passionate about this work that I'm doing with kids too. The idea.
Well, yeah, we'll talk about that in a second.
Okay. So you go to this Walmart. You're doing this everyday life kind of thing. Your reception, as you said, you've been quoted virtually everywhere saying I've been thrown out of more Walmarts than most people have been to. They were not very friendly. And then what was it that changed? What was the turning point that all of a sudden caused them to embrace you, Brendan?
Well, besides finding my wife in Boston, I feel indebted to GBH. Because,
tell us why.
I was on the Kelly Crossley show and I said
terrific.
I had been invited to leave more Walmarts than most New Yorkers have ever been in. And shortly thereafter, Walmart called and said, you know, we actually like what you do and we'd like to make it easy on you to get in stores. And so my unfettered access began.
And by the way, when they did this, did they say to you, however, there are a couple of rules of the game.
No.
You can't do X, Y.
No.
Rules whatsoever.
You know, I'd been doing it 4 or 5 years before. And I think they assumed correctly that if I had been going after the punchline, I would have hit it
yeah.
4 years before.
So tell us some of what you have painted in Walmart for people that are not familiar with your work. Like what?
Well, I had an out-of-work actress walk around and shop, bought her groceries. You know, I begged my wife to go in and shop and made paintings from her. And I was really intrigued by the idea of a lone figure shopping in the way that Edward Hopper did his lone figures. And then after a while, I started thinking about the boulevards of Paris and the boulevards of consumption that we have. And so I became intrigued by that and also just brands, our obsession with brands. And
well, you've painted like whole boxes of like Life cereal. That was in the paper this morning. And still lifes on the shelves at Walmart,
which is
too.
What causes some to call him the Warhol for obviously soup can
of
reasons of Walmart,
yeah.
Which is not a bad person to be compared to. Would you agree?
You know, he was more solvent than I am.
Well, Alec Baldwin is one of your biggest fans, the actor that you know we all are embarrassed to say how much we love him because he always does these outrageous things. But how did that happen?
Sweet.
You got hooked up. Sweet. That's an unusual adjective for him.
Man.
But was he not at a Walmart?
I have been friends with him since 1995.
Oh, wow.
This is a Paris thing, right? Isn't that where you first saw him?
I was doing portraits in the street in Paris, and we had a mutual friend, and I was his tour guide for a couple weeks, and we just remained friends.
But it was purely happenstance.
Happenstance, yes.
He's never cursed at you on the phone or screamed at you or nothing, none of those kinds
of
things?
Has he bought any of your paintings?
He's bought a lot of paintings.
That's wonderful.
You know, before you became a cover boy, which you have been, I mean, you're written about.
Wow.
No, you are. I mean, you're getting a huge amount of play. And I have to say, I've only seen your stuff online, and it is really powerful. I mean, it really does capture sort of every man and woman in America. I mean, really, there's that feel to it. Before that, when you sort of got into this Walmart thing, did you question yourself at all? Did you say, I'm about to give a major piece of my life to inspiration from a big box store that by the way, is a pretty controversial big box store. I know you stay out of the politics of it, but it's a pretty controversial place.
Well, yes. I didn't think about it consciously as I was going on. I started thinking about how irrevocable this place is and how much time and money and energy we spend in this environment and how millions of people enter the space unironically and go about their business. And so I kind of think it's interesting that no one else has addressed it, and it kind of just became my one of my domains.
Do you shop there?
Sure.
Do they give you a break?
No discounts.
No discounts.
I bought my almonds before I started painting yesterday.
So tell us about the city tour you're on, this everyartist.me. What is that, please?
So a year ago, we did a pilot test in Bentonville. The Rubin Foundation in New York and Walmart co-sponsored this event where I got 8,500 kids to interpret the same theme of art. And we brought it out of the classrooms and brought it onto the indoor football field of the local high school. And we thought this is the best pilot test for a national art event. And our goal this year is to get 1 million kids to participate in this event the week before Thanksgiving. And we now have 300,000 kids.
Oh,
and
my God.
We're inviting all Boston kids to join in, Boston schools, and we have a call in to Mayor Menino this week, and I'm seeing Senator Feingold tomorrow. And, you know, right now we're calling out for moms, art champions, anybody who believes as strongly as we do that creativity is the most important resource that we can foster in our kids.
So what does it mean? Would these 300,000 plus kids go to football fields all around America, or do they do it in their classroom?
Will each environment, 200,000 kids in Houston is going to host their own.
Okay.
But to be part of an Every Artist event, you simply need to download our kit.
Okay.
On our site, everyartist.me, we're developing a lot of an app that will make it easy to upload art. And we'd eventually like to project 1 million kids' artwork onto a national monument.
You know, one that's going to be a great test is, as I'm sure you know, that Tom Menino fought hard to keep a Walmart out of Boston about a year ago. But at the same time, I don't know many urban mayors who care as much about kids as this guy does. I mean, whether it's getting summer jobs or getting them involved in arts and humanities and that sort of thing. So having a Menino drawn in by a guy whose claim to fame is the imagery you've done from inside Walmart is going to be a wonderful test for your skills, I should say. What's your by the way, where can people see your Walmart work?
BrendanO'Connell.com.
And of them, and it's pretty hard on radio to do this, but I have a feeling you can visualize it. What are the one or two that you're most proud of, where people should start?
I don't
You don't rate your own stuff? No, there's got to be one where you say to yourself, this really captures what I was...
There's one called Checkout, which is pretty quintessential. And then there are a number of, you know, I really like that big Utz painting.
Mm-hmm.
And Utz called me and offered me a care package of snacks, which is very...
How big is that?
8 feet by 9 feet.
8 feet by 9 feet.
Six by eight.
Six by eight. That's a pretty big painting. We're talking with Brendan O'Connell, who's become famous for still lives, and not just still lives, but pictures of paintings of people shopping at Walmart. You've been compared to, you know, Warhol in Walmart, and also to Pizarro, and if I pronounce that right, Impressionist and Post-Impressionist, Seurat in France and stuff like that. You mentioned that you met your wife in Boston. Now, she is also a painter, correct?
In my mind, and in many other people's minds, she's the quintessential, you know, premier female landscape painter.
She is. Now, how did that work for you? She's the landscape painter, a premier landscape painter, and you're doing life cereal boxes in Walmart. Was there sort of a tension early on in the relationship?
For many years, she continues to do very, very well, and she just, you know, dragged me along, and I've been known as Emily's husband for many years now. now she's happy I can help pay the bills.
Okay. Hey, What's Emily's last name?
Buchanan. I'm sorry, Emily Buchanan.
Emily Buchanan.
James Taylor and Kim Taylor are two of her biggest supporters. And
so where are we talking these landscapes?
They're all over New England.
Great.
And right now she's painting on Fisher's Island.
Oh.
And so she gets to go to places like Fisher's Island.
Fisher's Island and Walmart. What a family. Just for a second, the politics of this. Obviously, everybody knows because there have been movies about lots of conversation in the news, whether it's the whole big box store issue, which upsets a lot of people, whether it's labor practices at Walmart. When you go into Walmart, while you have the imprimatur of the big boys and girls, the people who run the thing, how do the employees greet you? Are they happy to have – I know you can't generalize, but try to. Because you do, in essence, celebrate. And you may not say this, but having seen your work, it's the way I feel, is the everyday person who spends a decent part of their life in these places.
See, on the Globe website, you can actually see a guy who was sweeping up get interviewed.
Mm.
And his reaction was, you know, I think it's time we brought culture to this store.
There you go.
I thought that was the most amazing thing, that whenever we can see our environment in a more artful way, or anytime we experience beauty, I think our lives are enriched and we're enlivened by it.
So we find you at BrendanO'Connell.com. Is it .com or
.com?
.com and everyartist.me.
Hold on, one last thing. Is your mother live in Torrington, Connecticut?
No, my mother lives in St. Augustine, Florida.
Okay, then why did I see this reference to Torrington, Connecticut with your mother and Meryl Streep?
Oh, she was visiting me.
Okay, she was visiting you.
We should tell the story if you're beginning.
Tell the story about Meryl Streep at the Walmart.
So, just the idea that this is the most democratic place on earth, that my mom is in line in a store and there's a lady in a muumuu in front of her who could be in people of Walmart, and then Meryl Streep is behind her. And you know, this won't happen at Barney's or, you know, maybe Grand Central. But when you're in a place of transit, it's different than when you're interacting with goods and people.
Did your mother introduce herself to Meryl Streep?
No, she was very subtle.
Oh, okay.
Very subtle.
Closest I've ever had is at a Star Market in Somerville, standing in line behind Julia Child. But it's not quite. No one was painting us or anything. Brendan O'Connell, your work is beautiful.
Thank
really
you
appreciate
so much.
Your sharing some time with us. Thanks so much.
This is great.
And we're glad that WGBH plays such a pivotal role in your
pivotal
career.
Oh, and Pete, can people go to Quincy
people
Walmart and watch
Quincy
you do your stuff today?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
What do you mean? Why were you hesitating?
Join CBS. I think CBS is coming.
When will you be there?
4 to 6.
Great.
This
Brendan
is really
O'Connell.
Surreal. It's great.
Brendan O'Connell is, of course, a painter. He has done wonderful paintings at Walmart, and he's known as the Warhol of Walmart. Are you going to be not in Lynn, right? In Quincy.
Quincy.
That's
a
mistake. Okay. Thank you very much, Brendan, for being
so
with us, and thank you for doing that wonderful artwork in Walmart. Okay, so does the name Carlos Danger mean anything to you? If it doesn't, even if it does, stick around. We're going to bring you up to speed on the latest details surrounding Anthony Weiner's sexting scandal and how it's affected the New York City mayor's race. Keep your dial on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
This is Boston Public Radio, Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. One could argue the most exciting soundbite to come out of Boston City Hall in the last 20 years is probably this.
The car is no longer king in Boston.
That is true. And even though we have 12 candidates, it is 12 running for mayor, once again, Boston is being overshadowed by New York. Their mayor race is making ours look like a run for student council.
While some of the things that have been posted today are true and some are not, there is no question that what I did was wrong. This behavior is behind me. I've apologized to my wife, Huma, and I'm grateful that she has worked through these issues with me and that I've had her forgiveness.
That, of course, is former Congressman Carlos Danger, otherwise known as Anthony Weiner, in a press conference just yesterday, apologizing for these most recent revelations. Joining us online from New York to go over the latest developments and how they're playing on Anthony Weiner's sexting scandal is Brian Lehrer. He, of course, is host of The Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. Great to talk to you again, Brian.
Hi,
hey,
Brian.
Hey, good to talk to you. Now, wait a minute. You only have 12 candidates for mayor?
It's not enough.
You know, there are people getting into our mayoral race every other day. There are going to be like 7 different independent lines outside the Democrats and Republicans, and there are like 8 Democrats running in this primary. So only 12 candidates.
Oh, yeah. I had no idea there were that many, because the only person we ever hear about is Congressman Weiner. He's the guy that's grabbing all the headlines. So we were all glued to our sets yesterday when the congressman, or the former congressman, I should say, and his wife, his long-suffering wife, got up there at that press conference. I was riveted. What's the reaction today? Are people reassessing, thinking it's time for him to go? What's up down there, Brian?
I think people are reassessing. On my call-in show today, I asked specifically for anybody who was an Anthony Weiner supporter at this time yesterday, are you still an Anthony Weiner supporter today? And the calls we got were about 50-50. Now, I don't have to tell you, hosting your show, that when you ask for callers on a talk show, that is a thoroughly unscientific sample. But I think there was an indication there that if the people who felt passionately, you know, it's those who feel most passionately who tend to call in, to actually take the time and effort
right.
to call in. And if there were about as many people who were passionately supporting him and passionately saying, no, that's it, I'm no longer with him, I've been had, then I think that's a very bad indicator for him, and it represents very possibly a significant deterioration of his support.
Yeah, but I think some good news for Anthony Weiner is what you started this conversation with, Brian. It seems to me the broader and wider the field is, the lower the number one needs to get to be atop that field, which is one of the reasons I guess he's done so well in the polls. So the more the better in some ways for Anthony Weiner. Is that not true?
I think that is true. Certainly, there's, you know, many ways to split the vote. The way it works here is that if no candidate gets over 40% on primary day, then there'll be a runoff between the top two.
Mm-hmm.
And in all the polls so far, he's either been number one or number two. Now, a lot of people say that that's name recognition. And so people are only deciding, well, do I forgive Anthony Weiner enough to vote for him or do I not? Because the other candidates are truthfully lesser names to the average New Yorker. Now, I think as we get closer to Election Day, it's going to take off in a different way for some of the others as more people become disgusted with Anthony Weiner. But you're right, the more candidates who are in the race, the better it is for him.
A couple of questions off the New York Times this morning, Brian Lehrer of the Brian Lehrer Show at WNYC. The New York Times editorial says it's time to go. Do voters care what the editorial page of the New York Times says in New York City?
There's a certain group of mostly Democratic voters that does care what the New York Times thinks, that takes a lot of cues from the New York Times, especially in local races, not necessarily mayor, but local city council races and people who they may not know as well, candidates who they may not know, you know, the individuals as well. And if they, mostly liberal Democrats, trust the Times sensibility, they'll even take a Times editorial to the polls with them if there's a long list of races that they're going to vote on. I think, too, in something like this, it's just my gut, but I think on something like this, there will be people who are swayed by the sensibility of the Times, which would not reflexively try to destroy Anthony Weiner like the conservative New York Post would, but rather, you know, take all these factors into consideration. So I think it'll sway some people.
Well, is there an heir or heiress apparent here if Weiner does step aside? The city councilwoman that was expected to do so well, is she the obvious winner if he steps aside?
Yes, there are two obvious winners. One is definitely the city council speaker, Christine Quinn, who's been tied with him in the polls for first place as it is. She's a fairly well-known person in New York, and she's got her critics, but she's also got respect, and she's built coalitions in various political circles. Then there's Bill Thompson, who's the former city comptroller who was the Democratic candidate against Bloomberg 4 years ago, and he did better than he was expected to do. He's got kind of a lackluster reputation, but he's also the third-place runner, and he's the only black candidate in the race. He's been running third. So if Weiner drops out or really falls in his support, then Thompson would probably wind up in a one-on-one runoff with Christine Quinn. And at that point, anything could happen. He's also building a very interesting, diverse coalition of endorsements and ethnically diverse voter coalition. One funny thing, though, that I think if Weiner drops out, eventually it will change. Bill Thompson was only running third among blacks, even though he's the only black candidate in the race. Weiner was running first among blacks, which astonished people here when that poll came out. One possible reason for that is that a lot of black people know what it feels like to be marginalized and disqualified for something that you've done wrong in your past, and people don't give you a chance to make it up. And so were more inclined than others, this is just a theory, but it, you know, may be true to some degree, more inclined than others to say Anthony Weiner is a victim of the media and a victim of the establishment. I want people in general to be given a second chance. Eventually, a lot of those folks may drift back to Thompson anyway. And if Weiner drops out, then it helps Thompson a lot.
We're going to take your calls on this in about a second at 877-301-8970. But last thing from me, Brian, it sounds like I'm making the case for Weiner, which I am not. However, let me read to you from today one of today's many New York Times stories on this. He, meaning Weiner, went straight from the news conference to a forum on HIV and AIDS issues, arriving late as usual, etc. As he spoke passionately about issues like housing, gay rights, and health care, distinguishing himself — this is not an editorial, it's a report — from his rivals by rising from his chair and gesticulating forcefully, the audience responded warmly with shouts of, "Yeah, that's right, and you the man." I assume most of those people know what happened just before. So he may defy conventional wisdom, right?
Life is complicated. He and Elliot Spitzer — we can do another show on that another day —
yes, we could, yes —
are both leading in their respective races as of yesterday. You know, media love to talk about scandal. It doesn't necessarily land the way people experience it in their own lives. And the other thing is, as somebody who has hosted a fair number of these mayoral forums myself, I know Anthony Weiner is extremely effective. He is the best communicator out of the pack.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I did one in the 2005 mayoral election cycle when he was also running, where he was late, and there were several other candidates on the stage, and we were talking, I think it was about housing issues, and he came in late, and, "Oh, Anthony Weiner's late, da-da-da, what do you have to say about this?" And he gave 3 minutes that were so galvanizing to the audience, it was very clear who won that debate at the end of the night, with those mostly housing activists who showed up. But just to say, he's very effective, and he connects as somebody who knows policy, thinks outside the box, has ideas, and gets you. So,
Brian, one last thing for me. I would assume this is kind of an only in New York kind of situation. We were talking about this earlier. I don't think a mayoral candidate in Boston could withstand this sort of thing. But New York is different. What do you think? Is this a unique to New York kind of phenomenon? Sort of a
I have four words for you. Mark Sanford, South Carolina.
Beautifully put. Okay. Hey, Brian Lehrer, we're jealous. You're a lucky man. Brian Lehrer from the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. Thanks so much for your time again,
more
Brian.
Candidates. Send me more candidates.
Okay. Brian, it's great to talk to you. Our number is 877-301-8970. We want to play on what Marjorie just said to Brian at the end there, which is, we're in Boston. Think about a major city. Maybe you're somewhere in New Hampshire. Can you ever imagine an Elliot Spitzer running for city controller and an Anthony Weiner running for mayor and not being laughed out of town? Could this happen? Could you be atop the polls in your city if you're Anthony Weiner or Elliot Spitzer? It is surreal. Say, it's just unbelievable. 877-301-8970 is our phone number. You know what was interesting that Brian Lehrer said,
what?
which echoes, as someone, as he said, who's moderated mayoral debates in New York City, when he's talking about Weiner's first run for mayor, which I'd totally forgotten about till he said it, is the guy is a performer. I don't mean performer in a pejorative way. The guy is a good candidate.
He's a great
and
politician.
Obviously, but you hear what he said. You know what's amazing in this New York Times thing? He's the only one to stand up during the mayoral forum. You know who was the first person, I think, to stand up in a presidential debate? Now everybody does. I think it was Bill Clinton, if I remember correctly.
Bill Clinton?
Stands up out of his chair, creates a higher level of energy and excitement.
Well, he did that Oprah thing where he moved around the room.
No, really, exactly.
Got people to feel their pain.
But that matters. It really matters. 877-301-8970. Could this ever happen in Boston or in your city?
And you know what else? We now know that if you remember back, the People magazine, before they had a big piece in the New York Times magazine a few weeks back, just recently when everyone was speculating he was going to run for mayor, and indeed he did. But they had the People magazine piece before that. Now we know that at the same time they were in People magazine, he was sexting as Carlos Danger. And that's when his wife said, "Uma, I want people to know we're a normal family." And I just think, what is up with her.
Well, by the way, she spoke for the first time publicly. I said we should hear
from
her. She
was very classy, very classy.
She offered a few remarks. She read from a piece of paper. Here she is following her husband at yesterday's press conference. Huma Abedin.
Our marriage, like many others, has had its ups and its downs. It took a lot of work and a whole lot of therapy to get to a place where I could forgive Anthony.
877-301-8970. It's a surreal story. Let's start with Leah and Roslindale. You are next on Boston Public Radio with Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. Leah, thank you for your call.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I wish that Mr. Lair was still on the phone because I'm just calling to make a comment about the black vote. Now, we are not a monolith. We are not all going to vote for a black candidate, for one. Secondly, we're not all criminals who've had a past, and therefore we can identify with someone who okay. might have had some type of terrible past, and we give him a pass for his mistakes. That was so wrong, and I am very upset that you two didn't challenge him on that.
Well, Brian, let me say one thing that can't be challenged are the facts of the most recent poll I've seen where he has significant support in the black community. And Brian, I think, said quite explicitly, I am purely theorizing as to why he has significant black support.
And that's completely incorrect, coming from a person of color who has to navigate her way through politics.
Which part is incorrect? I'm sorry.
In his assumption.
Oh.
His assumption is incorrect.
Well, you know, I don't think you have to, Leah, I don't think you have to be a former criminal to think that people deserve second chances. I mean, I have some parking tickets in my past, but
his point was
that
a majority of the African American community has that type of nefarious past.
I don't think he was saying that.
Leah, we hear you. Thank you for the call. I don't think that's exactly how he said it either, but we accept your criticism on his behalf. 877-301-8970. But the facts are these. Prior to yesterday's press conference, he had a narrow lead over Quinn in this race in New York City, this multi-candidate field. As Brian Lehrer said, the field is getting broader. And I think, as I said to him, the bigger it is, the smaller percentage he needs to make it into a runoff where virtually anything can happen. But you know,
Anthony Weiner says, quote, I want to bring my vision to the people of New York.
You know what's necessary, I think, to put this in context?
What's that, Jim?
Everybody remembers when Weiner had his first press conference. I think it was the first. This is June 2011.
Uh-huh.
This is where he started, where he was denying sending any lewd photos to anybody via Twitter. Here he is.
I did not send that tweet. My system was hacked. I was pranked. It was a fairly common one. People make fun of my name all the time. When you name Weiner, you kind of get that. I've asked a firm to take a look at this. They're hiring an internet security operation. We want to make sure that it doesn't happen again.
He was looking for the real killer, and apparently found that it was him.
You know, you forget the one about where they showed him the picture of himself in his underpants,
mm-hmm.
and he said he wasn't sure if that was in fact him in those underpants.
I do remember that.
I mean, I think if you saw a picture of yourself in a pair of underpants, you'd know whether or not it was Jim in the underpants or not Jim in the underpants.
Let me ask you, sir, we've made light of at least a piece
of
this.
How can you not make light
of this? No. I don't mean him. Can you imagine a circumstance, a highly charismatic candidate, which he is,
mm-hmm.
who's got a long history, is a fighter, even though, as I said, I mentioned this a few weeks ago, he did an inaugural video, his first video, talking about his five major achievements in Congress, and the New York Times did a piece the next day debunking each of those five.
He doesn't have any.
But beyond that, he's a fighter type. Can you imagine? Create an Anthony Weiner, a fighter, charismatic, got a lot of energy in him. Imagine anybody who has those characteristics to the nth degree, but also has this. Can you imagine that person running for mayor in our current 12-person field?
Not in Boston.
And being amongst the top?
No,
and why is
not
that?
Because I think that there's a certain grittiness to people in New York that is different than Boston. We're a small town compared to New York City. There's almost like a, you know what, this guy is a real jerk, but he's our jerk and he's going to do good things for New York, and we like the fact that he's tough and resilient.
You think he can survive this?
I think this looks really bad because after he had resigned and after he confessed and after he was doing interviews in People magazine, he apparently is still doing what he's doing. It makes you think that the guy has some psychological
problems.
You
don't think it's possible his system was just hacked? 877-301-8970. Let's take Charmaine. You're in Boston. You are next on Boston Public Radio. Hi, Charmaine.
Hi.
Hi.
Thanks for taking my call.
Pleasure.
Just letting you guys know that
you're really, really passing over how important charisma is when it comes to people like Wiener. Wiener's a funny-looking guy,
mm-hmm.
but you have to think, what about him gets women to sex with him, or you know, phone sex with him, or whatever it is? There's something about him, and that charisma will go a long way for any politician or anyone who's trying to get you to jump behind them and
so to speak,
give them a little push in whatever direction they think they want to go. And you're talking about the kind of people who can come in with a new idea, and by the time you're done, you think it's yours.
Yeah.
And don't discount that in human beings, whether it's someone like Wiener or someone who had charisma in spades like Clinton.
How do you know someone's charismatic from a Twitter account?
Apparently, he is. Because
yeah.
there's something he's doing that enables him to continue this behavior. And it's got to be that he is able to engage people, even electronically.
See, I think I have to say, Charmaine, I think it's more the bad boy thing. I mean, we always read about someone's accused of murder, convicted of murder, and he gets 47 women emailing him or writing him proposing marriage. I think it's just the bad boy celebrity thing. I find it really hard. Marjorie has said this about 1,000 times. I'll say it for the 1,001st. The notion that there are women out there that find it attractive or charismatic that you send a picture of your private parts to any, I don't care who you are, is something that I just don't understand.
Unusual technique, although many men, I mean, these football players are doing it all the time.
They do.
So you think it's very attractive.
Not all the football players.
Not all the football players, but several of them have. But you know what I think is a big thing,
Charmaine,
going on
here?
Charmaine,
thank you for your point of view, though. We appreciate
it's
it.
It's the post-Bill Clinton reality. I mean, many of us were so judgmental about Bill Clinton and how can Hillary stay with him and she should throw his bags out in the front of the White House lawn and get out of there and blah, blah, blah. And now you say 20 years later, you know something? I mean, at least this is me. I don't know what the heck goes on in that marriage, the Clintons' marriage. But we got so distracted by that instead of paying attention to what we should have been paying attention to. And Osama bin Laden was one of the things we should have been paying attention to. Now you have fast forward to this. Now, this is kind of really a little weird, as the Reverend Eugene Rivers said, you know, keep your dirt regular in reference to Anthony Weiner, which is, I mean, Spitzer looks like he is keeping his dirt regular. He just was hiring a call girl instead of like
just
doing anything weird like this. Well, I think people don't
see
that.
I agree.
It's quite as odd. Bill Clinton was having affairs, and I think he was doing some other things that were much worse than that. But in any case, you kind of say to yourself, what are we electing here? You know, if this guy's going to be the mayor of New York, now you say he's not very effective, and the New York Times did this.
I don't know. I have no idea. I'm just telling what I read in the Times.
But if he's effective, if he's that kind of gritty guy in the Ed Koch, you know, model that goes out and really gets things done in New York and makes sure there's not squeegee people in every corner, make sure the garbage gets picked up, and he's tough, and he's going to give the unions a tough time, and he's going to give the cops a tough time, and he's going to be a tough mayor, you know, what the hell? If his wife thinks that this is fine, and I don't know how she thinks it's fine, but if she thinks it's fine, then get over it. Look who.
Well, Marjorie, can I tell you, I totally agree with half of what you said, which is the first half is if something happens and it's of this sort, my first instinct is totally between the two of them. If they want to deal with this, whether it's Hillary and Bill Clinton or Anthony Weiner and his wife, the question then becomes, does anything he did affect his ability to serve the public? And
well,
as you read the end of that same New York Times story, after a few minutes, he turned to his wife, thanked the press, and began to turn away. Just then, a reporter lobbed a final inquiry about the latest revelations. Quote, why should we trust your judgment? Mr. Weiner kept walking, leaving the question unanswered. I think that's a pretty legit. Even if you say, listen, if Huma is okay with him sexting, then fine. Put the sexting aside. Let me finish the thought. Put the sexting aside. But the question is, when a guy exercises that level of judgment, can he lead a city with 10 million people or 9 million or whatever?
From Bill Clinton, that there are some people who are able to totally compartmentalize their lives. So you may have great judgment about foreign affairs, great judgment about the American economy, and lousy judgment about fooling around on your wife. I think they're totally different things. The problem, I think, for Wiener is that you don't want to elect someone that you think is crazy. And you're beginning to think that this guy is really a little bit off the wall. I never thought Bill Clinton was crazy. I just thought he was, sort
Tom
of a
old
sex fiend.
Yeah.
Let's go to Frank in Burlington. What do you think, Frank?
Hi. I just think, it's been out of control, these people, with their
their lifestyles, and then we're like wondering, can they run the city? Can they do their job? And then, you know, the media gets all into their life, and it's like, does this guy have to go to a psychiatrist, like you said, in order to get the last okay that he's okay to run the city? I mean, what's it going to take?
He probably does at this point.
Yeah, you know, if he's going to back out, then. You know, I
but
guess
Frank,
you
but
the
Frank,
doctor's report.
Frank, let's assume you were living in New York City and you knew what we all know, and you knew what you liked where he was on policy issues. You found him attractive as a politician. After yesterday, could you vote for him for mayor of your city?
Well, I'm an Irish Catholic boy. I couldn't do it for just the sin alone. I think he would have to pay for his sin to lose my vote.
Frank, thank you very much for the call. Let's go to Rhode Island, where Mike is on Boston Public Radio with Jim and Marjorie. Hi there, Mike.
Hi. I'll be brief. I have two quick points to make.
Please.
One is that this kind of bad behavior able to get reelected is not that uncommon here in Rhode Island. We have the infamous Buddy Cianci, mayor of Providence for a long time. Hit a guy with a 2x4, convicted felon. If he were available to run today, he'd be the mayor of Providence again. They'd love him here.
Mike.
First thing they did when he got out of prison was give him a TV show.
Don't forget when he put the cigarette out allegedly on his wife's lover, right?
Yeah. What a classy guy. Huh?
I'm going to tell you a personal story about Buddy Cianci. In my early days at NECN, I've told you this, Marjorie, we were this close to closing a deal where I would co-host a show with Buddy Cianci. Mm-hmm. And when it appeared that this was going to happen, this is a true story, Cianci said to my boss, there are only two things that Jim may not mention at any time for me to buy into this, and ultimately it fell apart. What do you think two things were?
Toupee.
That's actually right. Was one. You can't mention the toupee. What was the second thing?
The cigarette in the hand.
Hey, Mike, thanks for a fine call.
Oh, the hand?
The cigarette in the hand.
The cigarette being put out.
Mike, thanks for the call.
I wasn't sure which body part he put the cigarette out on.
I'm not a Providence guy, but yep. I love Providence, but I don't. You lived there for a while.
I did. I love Providence.
My information is anecdotal, but I think Mike is right. Buddy Cianci is beloved. I mean, from his Pasta Sauce, which is a bestseller, to his radio show, and then his TV show.
Is Mike still on the line?
No, go ahead.
Because I was going to say Rhode Island, when I lived there, it was.
Oh, he is. Okay.
Mike, there's quite a colorful legislature in Rhode Island as well that Buddy Cianci was not that unusual coming out of, correct? I mean, there was a lot of Federal Hill jokes, mafia jokes, that kind of stuff when I lived in Rhode Island.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yeah, he fit right in with the crowd.
He fit right in with the crowd.
The non-political Federal Hill crowd at the back in the late 70s and early 80s when someone other than the government was running the most of Providence anyway.
Yeah.
Hey, for those who don't know, Federal Hill and Providence is sort of like the north end
where the
in
mob
Boston.
Mike, thank you.
I don't mean the mob part. I meant Italian restaurants and that sort of thing.
But that's
where
Raymond Patriarca used to sit out on his rocking chair, and that was one of the tourist attractions in Providence to go see if Raymond Patriarca, who was then the head of New England Cosa Nostra, would be sitting out there rocking back and forth on Federal Hill. I actually did see him twice.
You did?
The time I was, well, he was out there all the time. It wasn't that hard. You could just go right up there, and there he was. Anyway, Tracy from Sturbridge. What do you think, Tracy?
Well, I think there's a big difference between what's going on with Weiner and what's going on, like, for instance, with Mark Sanford down in South Carolina, because Anthony Weiner wasn't, at the same time he had these indiscretions, he wasn't working as hard as he could to tell people who to love or who to marry, to tell mothers and daughters and wives and sisters what to do with their bodies. He wasn't, you know, he was very involved with Focus on the Family. Mark Sanford was moralizing, which I think is just the absolute.
So you think he's worse than Weiner?
Absolutely, because Weiner wasn't at the same time moralizing and telling everybody how to live their lives. And Weiner's popular because his progressive policies are popular. You know, as a woman, once again, you know, it's interesting to see the fall from grace and this obsession with, I don't know what he was obsessed with, but I think it's a real difference.
Tracy, thank you for the call.
He was obsessed with photographs of himself in his underpants. That's what he was obsessed with.
For those who don't know,
I guess he thought he had an unbelievable physique, and he worked out a lot, and he thought that everyone should see his physique, even young women he didn't know, and were surprised to open up their phone and see, there's the congressman in his BVDs.
By the way, for those who don't know, and I assume people do, is that while Sanford obviously was governor and did the Appalachian Trail thing, which was in South America, he was just reelected to his original congressional seat, beating Stephen Colbert's sister, the Democrat in the race.
Well, he may have been a moralist, but he was also, this was, again, you know what happens. People have affairs. He fell in love and he married this woman. It was not.
Yeah, but she, but the caller, but the caller was. No, I agree. But the, and I think it's a very good point. It's there's perversion versus immorality if you can distinguish them. But you know, I the place where I agree with the prior caller, it's like of all the members of Congress who have done these unbelievable things, it is the hypocrites that drive me most nuts. When people rail against gay rights, and we find out 4 years later the representative is a gay person. David Vitters, the guy we I think we talked about him yesterday, the senator from Louisiana. I don't know if he was a rep or a senator then, who was, he was another one of the family values types.
Right.
He's in the D.C. Madam's little black book. I mean, so, well, I hear what you're saying, and I'm surely not defending Wiener. The hypocrisy in some cases is even more painful. Let's take one or two more quick ones. Peter, you're in Stoneham. You're next on Boston Public Radio. Jim and Marjorie, hi.
Hi, how you doing?
Great.
Good.
Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
The one thing about Mr. Wiener that I haven't heard folks talk about that's really puzzled me is this repetitive nature of his behavior. He's got some kind of addiction, compulsive behavior problem, and, you know, I understand that he wants to show himself off, but there are appropriate ways to do it, inappropriate ways to do it,
yeah,
right?
Right.
So, I mean, I think that just compromises a person, their ability to make good judgments, and, yeah, okay, so maybe some people can compartmentalize their lives, but I don't think that that's really true. I think that this is a problem that is pervasive to him. Why aren't people talking about the next time we're going to see Mr. Wiener's private parts again?
Well, Peter, that is one of the things that's starting to be sort of talked about, at least today, is that there may be some, that this could be, maybe he's got some kind of bipolar thing going on where he's hypersexualized and he just can't help himself. And this is a habitual sort of thing. So, I mean, we're playing shrink here, and I have no idea, but this was even in the stories today, that it does beg the question, okay, you do it, you get caught, you have to resign from your job, then you keep on doing it.
How'd you like his defense yesterday? I told you more stuff was going to come out. Let's take one more quick one. Peter, thank you. Judy in Arlington, you're going to wrap this up right here on Boston Public Radio. Hi, Judy.
Thank you so much. Well, I was going to bring up pathology as well. I believe he has, speaking of Colbert, a truthiness problem. Yeah, and you said Colbert, so thank you so much. But anyway, when I was listening to that clip from 2011, I was struck by how convincing he sounded. And that's
what
the liars are like. And he clearly has a different sex addiction or some kind of thing like that, too. But it's really, to me, that's the reason you would never want him to be elected, because especially debunking, the New York Times debunking his claims, it sort of speaks to liarness.
Liarness and truthiness. Hey, Judy, that was great. Thank you very much
for
your call.
We can all be glad we're not married to Congressman Wiener, whom his parents must be so thrilled that this is the guy of all the men she chose. And she seems like she's so together, and then she's with this guy. Anyway, when we come back, it is time for Open Mic with the editor of the Boston Globe, Brian McGrory. Stay tuned for that conversation. We'll ask him about the congressman as well. This is Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. He joins us every Wednesday on Open Mic. He's the editor of the Boston Globe. Welcome, Brian McGrory.
Hello, Jim Browdy. Hello, Marjorie.
Hello, Brian McGrory. So, Brian, one of our producers, well, she is our producer, actually, Chelsea, mentioned this morning that very early this morning on CNN, you know, they have the crawl that goes down underneath the news page.
Yeah.
Hernandez, Sergeant Murphy, the guy who leaked the photographs to Boston Magazine of Tardashev, and Whitey Bulger. The three big stories are all ours in Boston. I mean, this is extraordinary.
Well, it is extraordinary, except for it isn't any longer, is it? I mean, my God, since April, it feels like we have been the epicenter of national news, at times international news. It's like one thing after another.
I guess, but it's an unbelievable. I mean, it's usually New York. It's usually Washington. I think
or there's
the
one
first.
Story out of Boston, not the trifecta. The three lead national yeah. stories, according to these people, is unbelievable.
Yeah, it just. I mean, again, though, it's just since the bombs went off on Boylston, it just feels like it really has been one thing after another, news-wise. And I don't know. It's almost It's as if the bizarre is becoming routine here in terms of yeah. the level of news coming out of this town.
You know, speaking of bizarre, we solved a 50-year-old cold case with DeSalvo about a week ago, another obviously national story. And now we have what I guess I'll call a week-old cold case, Stephen Raikes. No wallet, no car, no trauma, according to the initial reports, and his body allegedly moved. Are you surprised it's 7 days and we have no idea why Stephen Raikes is dead?
Yeah, I'm stunned. I mean, it's really odd. It's really odd. The timing couldn't be any more strange, or is it stranger? I'm not sure. But it's almost incomprehensible when this happened. The questions that are surrounding it, the lack of answers that we're getting. It's tough to get your head around this one.
Do you
we're not getting answers about anything, it seems, these days. So this is not that extraordinary.
Well, we went over that last week.
We did.
And it just gets more frustrating every week, at least on the Stephen Raikes case. It's not as if we suspect that law enforcement was involved in this and we weren't getting answers. That's when it gets really frustrating.
Well, you know, speaking of that and speaking of transparency, we're going to broach this later, but it's sort of it fits here. We've been talking about how hard the Globe's had to sue the state to get information. We talked about that a couple of weeks ago and last week. On Monday, you guys reported that the Civil Liberties Union branches in Boston, in Massachusetts, and in Florida were asking their attorneys general to begin investigations about what happened in that apartment in Orlando where Ibrahim Todashev, who theoretically was about to sign an admission that he and Tamerlan Tsarnaev were responsible for the unsolved triple murders in Waltham on the 10th anniversary of 9/11, the FBI has reported virtually nothing. They said Attorney General Coakley in Massachusetts, give us some information. Brad Puffer is the spokesperson for Martha Coakley. I think it was in your paper, actually, said they had no intention of doing an investigation, even though two state troopers paid for by the taxpayers of Massachusetts were part of this suspicious killing. What do you make of this?
Well, you got to the very important point right at the end there, Jim. We had two state cops in that apartment at the time, and we've heard conflicting information about whether they were in the room or stepped out of the room, where they were, what their role was. We've gotten conflicting information about everything that went
what
on.
What weapon
in that
Todashev had or did not have.
And whether there was a knife or a sword
or nothing.
Or nothing at all. And it is, I mean, we can say this every week until the cows come home. It is really disturbing about how this is being handled, and it really fosters no confidence in how the FBI handled this when they're taking this long to issue some sort of report or investigation results.
And they've got the roommate or girlfriend or whatever she is held on possible deportation issues.
Total shows, yeah.
And she could be obviously a witness to what went on down there. They're going to ship her out of the country maybe before we have a chance to take a statement.
Yeah,
but I don't get why Martha Coakley can't look into at least the two state troopers' involvement here or
no,
give some explanation.
You're absolutely right. I mean, why? I mean, I'm assuming those troopers have been questioned up here in some form or fashion. You know, let us know what's going on there. They shouldn't be beholden to the FBI on this. They should be out in front of it.
Why do we have this discussion every week? I mean, there's a major story every week in which our government, our being the operative word, our government is unwilling to give us information that I think an objective person would suggest we're entitled to. We're not asking for secret details of an investigation that might damage their prosecution. Well, there's no prosecution, guys. Both guys are dead who allegedly did the Waltham killing, according to the FBI. What is it? Is it that political leaders don't demand it on our behalf anymore, so they hope that we have short attention spans and we'll just move on to the next thing?
Well, let me take this to a slightly different place, Jim. I
sure.
forget whether we did this last week or not, but even if we did, it's worth revisiting. We have requested information that we're publicly entitled to from the Boston School Department about teacher performances and how they break down from school to school. We're not looking for the results of individual teachers and how they perform their evaluations. We're looking for how schools did as a whole in keeping the identities of the teachers secret. We just want to know school to school, the teacher evaluations and how they held up. We have every right to that information. It is public information. We should have it in our hands. It would help people in this city whose children go to schools in Boston. And what does the school department do here in Boston? They deny us the information, and they're going to fight us tooth and nail about it.
So you're going to have to go to court? You're going to have to go to court with the school department over this?
Yes, absolutely. We will end up doing that, and if they think we won't, they're crazy. We will take them to court over this, yes.
Were you going
to
say that's a fine kettle of fish?
Well, I was going to say that's a fine way for the school department, which isn't rolling in dough to be
also
spending its money.
Also paid for by us.
Exactly. I mean, I find it unbelievable. You know, I gave a talk to League of Women Voters, and Jim was the one that told me I should go do it. And I talked about they're very involved women, right? That are, you know, they're volunteering and they used to do the debates and all that kind of stuff. I talked about this lack of disclosure from the government. They looked at me like I had three heads. I mean, no one seemed to get or be upset or concerned about what I was talking about. This is right in the middle of the NSA and the IRS. So you get the sense out there, Brian, that this is what we worry about as reporters, and the general public is kind of ho-hum, even the League of Women Voters.
Yeah, I don't know if I agree with that, Marjorie. I mean, I'm not disputing what the reaction from the League of Women Voters. But
I would if I were you.
Maybe
go ahead.
My speech was bad. I do know.
Well, did you have to say, you know, can people wake up here? Can people wake up? Kidding. What I do know is that when we run stories of an investigative nature, spotlight stories, that kind of thing, that actually expose misdeeds on the part of any government officials, we get an enormous reaction here. So there is a thirst, a desire for more information, not less. I think that if you're in the public, you have a hard time fathoming what it is we in the news business go through to get some of this information. And that's why it's tough for them for readers to process.
Now, I know this is one of your favorite times each week that you're with us. This is the Friday news quiz, or Wednesday news quiz for Brian McGraw. You ready, Brian?
Oh, boy.
Who is Fernando Menes, Brian McGraw, in the news? Who's Fernando Menes?
Well, why do you do this to me?
It's a simple question. Marjorie knows. Who is Fernando Menes, please?
Why do you do this?
Okay, do you want to know who it is?
It's like inviting me into your house and slapping me around.
Fernando, if you go to slate.com and you type in the name Brian McGraw, there is a converter which gets your sexting pseudonym, and your sexting pseudonym would not be Carlos Danger like it is for Anthony Weiner. Yours would be Fernando Menes. What do you think of that, Brian?
Is that really...
Why don't you ask Jim what his name is, Brian?
It's probably Jim Browdy, but
no. Well, thank you. No, it's Pepe Distress. No, but you know,
is that story great or what?
One of the best ever.
Well, we were talking about this morning, Jim and I. Can you imagine in Boston if we had a mayoral candidate who was involved in a sexting scandal? I don't think. What do you think? Would they last for 2 minutes or what?
Oh, God. They wouldn't last for as long as it took to take that picture. This is incredible. So what happens to him now? Does he actually hang in there now?
But what he said yesterday, I don't know if you watched the live press conference. I couldn't get enough of it. First, he speaks. We just talked about this with listeners a few minutes ago. He speaks, and then his wife speaks, which is just mortifying. And by the way, Andy Barwitz, who's our favorite satirist, had a blog up yesterday.
Oh, my says, God, about shooting pictures of himself while he's at the press conference.
Yes, Weiner continues sexting during apology, which is true. But, you know,
don't forget the hashtag, the free Huma.
Free Huma, yeah, exactly, on Twitter. But, you know, in great part, you know, he said, I told you. I mean, it's almost like, you know, I told you there was more to come. And the only thing that this adds to the prior horrible story is he kept doing this after he resigned from Congress. So if New Yorkers were willing to accept him prior to yesterday, and apparently he had a slight lead in the polls in this multi-candidate field for mayor, why should one assume that they're going to be less willing to accept him? And by the way, women support him in almost the same numbers that men support him in New York City.
Well, Jim, isn't there a big distinction? If more pictures had come out that we didn't know about that had taken place before the public disclosure, forgive the word disclosure, that would be one thing. That it was just more of the same. The fact that he called out on this resigned from Congress and saw the repercussions of his behavior and humiliated his wife and then kept doing it really gets to some character issues there, or beyond character issues, a real mental health issue.
Well, I think that's a lot of, because my attitude about this, and was my attitude about the Clintons too, unless it affects your public performance, whatever couples decide to do or not do is their business. But there really is a mental health. I think you raise a wonderful point about a guy who continues to have this death wish, apparently, in New York City.
But presuming he doesn't fall totally in the polls in New York, and maybe he will, but maybe he won't, is it that New York is just so down and dirty, no pun intended here, that we're just too small of a city? Because, you know, I was down in New York visiting two of my kids this weekend, Brian, and everything is so, everybody's so pressed together, and it's, you know, so overwhelming. You could see where New York could elect somebody like this.
Yeah, you could. You could. I mean, I often, Manhattan is great. It's just, it's a great place to visit. I would not want to live there.
Me neither.
I regard it as the most crowded but loneliest place on the planet.
Yeah.
Maybe it is that they're all so busy that, this is an interesting sideshow. It's entertaining, so why not keep them going, you know? Because it's – who are the other candidates? I've never heard of half of them.
Well, this woman, Quinn. who was
liberal.
Leading everywhere. She is not only a big liberal. I believe she's a lesbian, and she's getting huge. I mean, it would be the first lesbian who would be a serious candidate for mayor, at least a person who is publicly out. And she was allegedly going to win this thing. She's on the city council and over, and apparently she's getting nowhere. Hey, listen, Fernando, I want to change topics Brian, I want to change topics. You guys ran a story that I loved. I think it was over the weekend. Andrea Estes, one of my favorite reporters, Scott Allen, too, two great reporters. There is a box of bones that is delivered anonymously, mailed anonymously. And by the way, the video has this great thing, not just with Scott Allen, but with the newsroom, the mailroom guy at the Globe, which I totally love. Give us the short version of this box of bones that's delivered anonymously to the Globe and then what ultimately it turns out to be.
Well, so quite literally, this box of bones arrives at the paper last October. And, the mailroom opens it up, and it's a human skull with a bunch of other skeletal remains. And they bring it up to the newsroom. It's an unusual package for us to get, probably the most unusual we've ever gotten here. My predecessor, Marty Baron, called the cops and let them know about it. And there was a note inside. There were notes back from... the 1970s? The 70s or 80s?
I think it was the 70s, but yeah.
And a note signed Veritas describing, you know, in some scant detail what the bones might have been or were. And so we took that. Andrea Estes, who's as good a reporter as there is in the city. Scott Allen, who's as good an editor and reporter as there is in the city. Followed a path with the help of authorities and actually were able to identify what happened here. And it ends up it was a boating accident, or one of the bones, one of the sets of bones was from a boating accident that occurred down off the South Shore. It was brother and sister and their respective dates were on Memorial Day weekend, were out on a boat, and the boat was found overturned in the water, and their kind of belongings were found floating in the water. The family had long suspected foul play, and the bones were identified as one of those people, and it brought closure to these families. And the other remains were from a couple of hundred years old from what was believed to be a Native American buried somewhere out in the Worcester area, I believe, Leominster or something like that.
Yeah, but while it brings closure to one piece, that's one of the reasons I love the story and love the accompanying video, is there's still mysteries. I mean, they go out to the apartment building. Where Veritas? They go to the address on the Veritas thing, and of course they can't find the person. Who is the person?
We are hoping very much, and if you are out there, Veritas, tell us who you are. You did something very important here, and we're wondering what else you might have. This gets to a lot of issues. What other sets of bones might be out there? What other sets of bones might be sitting in somebody's garage? What other mysteries remain unresolved? What other families don't have closure that should? There are a lot of issues still swirling around here, and you know, we will gladly play a role in whatever way we can in resolving them.
It's a great story. I loved it.
So Brian, changing subjects here, Bill Belichick is going to have a press conference today, meet with reporters, and the Hernandez case is obviously all over the news, possible involvement with this double murder in Boston last summer. What should Bill Belichick do? Should he address this today?
I don't know how to put this politely, but this isn't the type of thing that's in his wheelhouse.
Yeah.
You know, it's I hope he does say something. I hope he doesn't just decide to slough off the questions as we have, you know, suspect he may. I hope he does take this head on and say, look, you know, well, you know, I'll leave it to him what to say, but I hope he does address it. We had, the Globe had a story today that there is a grand jury that's hearing testimony on this case, and that the case against Hernandez is strengthening in that double murder from 2012 over by the old Herald building. And,
yep.
I mean, it would be pretty chilling if a double murderer was actually playing for the New England Patriots last year after he committed those killings.
You know, I think this is at 1:45 this afternoon, and I think it's not only a test for Bill Belichick to show if he has compassion in his body, if he's almost a human being. It's also a test for reporters. I have to say, what drives me nuts in these Belichick's thing, I know it's ordinarily only sports, but now it's about some a death or possibly three deaths, is the reporters are so cowed. And I hate to make a broad statement, but I will. I know there's some dramatic exceptions. They're so cowed by this guy that even if there's a major story, when he says, I'm not talking about it anymore, very few of them do their job, which is to continue to ask the questions. And if he chooses to either not answer them or obfuscate, that's fine. But the questions have to be asked, no?
Yeah, I'm not sure I 100% agree with you, Jim. I think that there are a lot of reporters in this setting who do continue to ask the questions. But, you know, once they shut them down, I mean, do you just keep shouting above?
Well, obviously, if they, yeah.
Brian, what's going on here?
Don't do this, Marjorie.
That Jim
you said this
thinks
upstairs.
That he's the man to
okay,
go down
fine.
There and take on Bill Belichick, mano a
mano.
I
mean, how many times do I have to tell the story about running into Jim at a campaign press event up in, presidential campaign press event up in New Hampshire?
Oh, tell us again.
He's actually live at the event, but he slinked off into a corner.
This is the
no
first Romney. The first
making
Romney.
No
Bill
eye
McCain.
Contact with everyone, afraid. Scared to death that somebody might approach him and try to have a conversation. This is a guy that's going to get on a Foxborough and
exactly.
tell us
all.
Yeah,
first of all, I've told you, Brian, I wasn't feeling well on that day. Now, Brian, since you were criticizing me, I wasn't going to do this. I feel I am now speaking on behalf of virtually all Globe readers. How disappointed I and we are about your treatment of the debut of the royal baby. Some pathetic little picture on the left-hand column of page one. You should be ashamed of yourself. I assume you acknowledge it was a big mistake, correct?
I am going to write a front-page apology for our lack of attention on what is obviously the most important international
yeah,
story.
You guys,
to Marjorie,
you guys just make fun of this. I was up into the wee hours watching Will and Kate Plus One on CNN, their extensive coverage of how they met, their courtship, you know, all through college, how they broke up and got back together and how she played hard to get. And, you know, you could see how he was losing his hair. He had a bunch of hair when he was like 18 or 19
yeah,
years old, and now he's going bald.
That.
But how he, I think when he gets totally bald, he'll be really good looking again. Anyway, I think it's a gender thing. I think a lot of women are transfixed by this story.
Well, let me try to take something back. Would you, last week on your show, I kind of glibly asked, so who is the father, making it sound like the princess or whatever she is had multiple
or whatever.
I didn't mean it like that. I mean, I forgot the father's name. Everyone
yeah.
knows who the father is.
Will.
Yes. But speaking of debuts, can I throw a quick plug in here?
Sure. Yeah.
Shirley Leung, our new business columnist,
yes.
had what I think was a fantastic first column. And Marjorie, as you know, starting a column is no small thing.
No,
and,
you're a nervous wreck.
I think that Shirley hit the thing out of the park today, and we are very excited to have her as a Globe business columnist.
And we actually should have, we should have her on soon, too. I thought it was great. Too. You know, Brian, we're still not done with this thing. Just one more a serious question. You have to decide, I mean, this is part of your job, about what you believe the public should know and what the public wants to know, and they're not always the same. The reality is, obviously, the TV stations have done surveys on this, polling focus groups, or they wouldn't be leading with this baby story nonstop for 36 hours. How do you make – I'm serious about this. How do you make that decision when you know everybody, unfortunately, most everybody, wants to read about this?
Unfortunately.
Well, wants to read about this, but at the same time, you know, the news value is modest at best. How do you make that decision?
Well, everything is relative to what else we have going that day. And look, I understand there's interest. It's not deep interest. It's a passing interest. So, for instance, the kid
Speak
was born.
Speak for yourself, Brian.
The kid was born, what, 2 days ago? So the first day in the paper, Boston.com led their website.
Did they
our
ever?
Website. So we made a big deal about it there in that venue, which I think is fairly appropriate. But on the front page of the Globe, what we had was a picture that maniacal-looking town crier yelling about the baby. And we did that for two reasons. One, we wanted to acknowledge below the fold that the kid was born. And also, I love the picture. We love the picture here. It was
a crazy guy
screaming. And then today, first view of the baby, we did want to get it on the front page. We have it in what we call the rail, which is our in-the-news column of briefs that are inside. And we have stories inside. So I think, you know, Jim, you ask a serious question. I'm trying to give a serious answer here. We understand there is there is little news value but major interest, so we try to thread that needle.
And by the way, I should say, your picture today teases a story tomorrow that I'm dying to read entitled Pippa the High School Years. I'm really... Now that...
You know, Marjorie, I try to give him a studious answer, this is what I get.
You could be talking about Anthony Weiner and Huma and the sexing of some people
Huma
in their underpants, whatever her name is, or you could be talking about this young couple. They're in love. Very they fine. Seem so happy. There's a new baby. It's an upbeat story. I mean, it's just you guys just are not romantic enough. I'm surprised at you, Mr. Buddy, the rooster who made me a family man. You seem like more of a romantic guy.
Oh, come on. The royal couple is not a romantic story.
Of course it is.
No, I mean, come on.
I think, let me tell you something, the story it's on, you got to find out who the father is. By the way, Shirley's first piece is entitled, I should have said this because it was great, Watching the Mayoral Race from the Sidelines, talking about the business elite, are they going to get involved? Hey, Brian McGorry, great to talk to you. We'll talk to you again next Wednesday.
Jim, Marjorie, thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Brian. As always, Brian's with us every Wednesday at 1 o'clock for Open Mic. Stay tuned for tomorrow's Open Mic appearance of Christopher Lydon at 1 o'clock on Thursday. Now, I just want to mention, because you guys have been making fun of this royal birth nonstop, that we finally have a name for the new little baby. Yes.
What is it?
The prince is named George Alexander Louis.
That's fabulous.
And I wonder if it had anything to do with the fact that, remember the King's Speech, the movie about the king that stuttered?
Award winner, sure.
Yes, his name
was
George. And the father, of course, Queen Elizabeth right now, so you wonder if maybe that's why he's named George. It took them 7 days to name Prince William, and it took them
Did
a month
to name...
Did
you say the father was Queen Elizabeth? Is that what you said?
No, I hope not. Did I say that?
No, I was kidding. Go ahead. What's coming up?
Oh, what's coming up? This is very exciting. We're going to be joined. Well, when it comes to urban renewal, we all know Boston really doesn't have that much space, not a lot of leeway when it comes to what developers can build from scratch. But it's this so-called predicament that has architect Scott Burnham rethinking how the city can reinvent what it's already got. This is fascinating stuff. He joins us next at 89.7 WGBH.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. I am Jim Browdy. She is Marjorie Egan. Joining us in Studio 3 is someone who we hope Boston's next mayor pays a lot of attention to. His name is Scott Burnham. He's a guy who has traveled around the world studying the best that urban renewal can bring to cities. He now wants to see these innovations done here and elsewhere. And as Marjorie just said, essentially reinventing what we already have. Scott, it's a pleasure to see you.
Thank you very much.
So there's this new exhibit going on right now at the Boston Society of Architects. What is it?
The exhibition is called Reprogramming the City, Opportunities for Urban Infrastructure. What it is a global overview of ways in which the existing infrastructure of cities around the world is being repurposed, reimagined, and completely reinvented to serve at times alternate functions within the city, and at times taking the existing structures, objects, and systems in the city and having them serve entirely new functions for the city.
Okay, we have a great picture here. I don't know if this is a street light or what this is, but it's some kind of pole kind of deal. And around the pole, there's umbrellas that can open. On a day like yesterday when we had torrential rain, you could put the umbrellas are down, right? And then when it rains, I guess you run into them and put them up.
Exactly. That is called the Lamp-brella, as the name would imply. It is a lamp umbrella. It's by a St. Petersburg, Russia designer named Michael Bielev. And it's taking an existing street lamp and applying an umbrella to it, which has a sensor in it. And when it rains, the sensor activates and it puffs up the umbrella.
So automatically.
Automatically. So anyone walking by, the moment it starts, a torrential downpour yesterday, perfect example. You're without your umbrella.
Yes.
You're in between buildings. It starts to rain. Well, the umbrella also knows that it just started to rain and it pops open and you stand underneath until it stops raining. The umbrella goes down and you continue on your way.
Can you imagine how much fun this would be for people? You know, if you were out, you could meet, this could be like a dating service. You could be out on the street, it starts torrential rain, you're all huddled of six people under this big, huge umbrella.
That's great, but you know what's, but what really intrigues me about this, Scott, is not just things that are really creative and serve a function, but things that are needed, well, I guess that's needed too, in dense communities. Someone, Cambridge, I think, is the fifth densest city in America, mm-hmm. Somerville's sixth, or maybe I have it backwards. Having dual purposes for things like that, but things like iPavement. What is iPavement? That's part of your deal too.
Exactly. iPavement is from Madrid, Spain, and it's an amazing project that it's taking existing paving slabs or sidewalk squares and putting Wi-Fi routers into them. And so basically the street itself becomes a Wi-Fi enabled surface.
Love this.
Now, what this is especially good for is the outerlying areas of the city that maybe don't have, that aren't hardwired into the telecommunications infrastructure of the city. Well, every place needs a hard surface. And so as you're laying down sidewalks or paving areas of that, why not lay down the sidewalks and paving areas that are Wi-Fi enabled? So you're not only extending sort of the hard surfaces of the city, you're actually extending access to the internet through to these areas.
Now, most of these things in this exhibit, and by the way, if you have creative ideas how you'd like to see repurposing or dual purposing, for lack of a better expression, of some of the things in our cities, give Scott a call at 877-301-8970. The dual purposing is spectacular, but some of it, did you just suggest a minute ago, some of it's repurposing. Marjorie hates parklets, for example. I know it's mentioned in one
because
of the stories.
Because we don't have any so parking you, spaces in Boston.
Right, so that concept where you essentially take parking spaces and then make a little patio you can sit in outdoors, that's not a dual purpose thing. That's a repurpose thing,
yes,
right?
Yes, exactly.
And so
exactly.
You have those kinds of things through
well,
it?
Well, I mean, a very good repurposing, to talk about the parking infrastructure technique, is the existing parking pay machines that we have, those large black iron structures on every block. Those are being outdone or outdated by smartphone apps. And at a lot of European cities, you can GPS, just say, I've parked right mm-hmm. here and I'm going to pay for it. So you actually don't need those machines. But let's think about those machines. Within those machines is a Wi-Fi system. They're GPS enabled. There's a computer. There's a printer. They're solar powered. Now, if I told you all those things, I've got a thing that's solar powered. It's got GPS. It's a printer. It's a computer. It's got a payment system. What can you do with it? You'd say, well, anything. But at the moment, we just have these machines issuing 30-minute tickets for people to park. So we're repurposing those. We're having them serve an entirely new purpose. And within the BSA space on Congress Street in Boston is a reprogrammed parking pay machine. And this now serves as a two-way communication platform with the city of Boston itself. You hit a ticket, you hit a button, and it prints a ticket, and it says, the city of Boston tells you, okay, these are the faults that have been reported in this area. Streetlight's been out, a pothole's been reported, and here's how we're responding to these things in the city. You know, we're on it. We've currently fixed the streetlight. Someone will be there tomorrow afternoon for the pothole. And it's so now that thing, which normally just serves a very utilitarian purpose, we've completely programmed, with the help of Mayo Neeson, who led the city tickets project, completely repurposed it. And it's now serving an expanded, entirely new function within the city.
We're talking with Scott Burnham. There's this new exhibit at the Boston Society of Architects. Where is that, by the way?
It's on Congress Street.
Congress Street, near where this new repurposed parking thing
exactly.
is. Talking about repurposing things and also giving things dual purposes. You mentioned this other thing that's going on in Boston. This is in one of the pieces, actually. I think this was from Boston.com, about this old payphone kiosk. What's happening with that?
Yes. Well, there's in New York, they've taken the old payphones, which again are a piece of urban infrastructure that's being outdated by cell phones, etc., and they've turned it into a series of touchscreen. Think in terms of a large iPad that you can walk up to it and you can find out essential information. You know, where's the closest taxi? What are the directions to MoMA, etc. Now it seems like a fairly obvious thing, and it's a great public service, and it's so incredibly simple because the telephone, of course, is access to the entire internet. So within these payphone kiosks, which are becoming outdated pieces of urban infrastructure, you have access to the global telecommunications infrastructure. So by just replacing the old handset with now these touch screens, you're using the exact same functionality of it, but by expanding its usefulness in the city exponentially.
You can watch Anthony Weiner press conferences at virtually every street corner in New York City. Number is 877-301-8970. If you have creative ideas about dual dual use, repurposing things in your city, in your community. Give Scott Burnham a call. Are most of these, I know you've traveled the world, going to a lot of countries, are we as much a laboratory for this kind of creativity in this country as others are, or are most ideas coming from them to us?
We should be, and at the moment we're not.
Why is that?
I'm not entirely sure. I think that Boston as a city, I left Boston 16 years ago, and I just moved back a few months ago. So I've had this incredible kind of before and after mm-hmm. relationship with the city. Boston's a great, great success story. I question whether it's become slightly complacent, why it's not going after kind of the big ideas. A lot of these, the grand majority of these projects come from cities outside of the states. I mean, there's a lot of cities. There's even projects from Milwaukee, Los Angeles. There's some great projects within the states. But I have to say that none of the projects in the exhibition actually come from Boston. One of the purposes of this exhibition is to become a catalyst for new ideas, a catalyst for new ways of thinking, and to hopefully to invigorate an entirely new generation of urban creativity.
Have you heard either from the current mayor or any of the 12, I guess it's 11 men and one woman, who want to be the next mayor?
I have not. I'd welcome a conversation with any of them. To be fair, however, the city of Boston has been wonderfully supportive of the exhibition itself. All the physical materials, the signs, the objects, everything in the city has been directly supplied by the city of Boston. They've also supplied the parking machine for reprogramming in the space.
That's all been pulled out while you're speaking, by the way.
So is there a country that's particularly creative along these lines?
I mean, Every place is entirely unique in its own character. Let me give you one example.
Okay.
I could give you literally 30 examples right now. But let's say Lima, Peru,
yep.
It has an exceptional project where they've taken an existing tall billboard. You'll see the same type that exists on the side of the bridge on 93 coming out of Boston. You've taken a large billboard which reaches into the sky. Lima is the second driest city in the world. It lives
dry meaning water, not dry meaning alcohol. No, I'm serious. I mean, you mean there's water issue.
There's a huge water issue. Mm-hmm. The only city that is in more desert terrain is Cairo. A lot of people who live on the outskirts of Lima don't have access to water, to the municipal water system. So they've taken an existing billboard and they've turned it into a humidity collector. The air in Lima is incredibly humid. So over the course of the night, it will collect the humidity from the air and turn it into drinking water. And in the morning, it's no more difficult than walking up to the base of the billboard and turning on the tap and getting drinking water. That billboard produces 25 gallons of clean drinking water every single day. And
wow.
Its previous existence was just selling things.
Wait a minute. So do people just come up with their cups in the morning, or is there some municipal drainer person?
No, people from surrounding villages will come with huge water containers, put it right underneath the faucet, turn it on, and fill up, 5-10 liters at a time and bring them back.
You know, Scott, there's another piece. I don't know which piece writing about your exhibit and your work this was mentioned in, but talk about this combination bus stop light therapy kiosk. Now, Marjorie, don't say what I know you're going to say. Is this Sweden? Is that where that was from?
Yeah, it is Sweden.
Tell us about this.
This is a brilliant project. This is a city in Umeå, Sweden. Umeå is 300 miles north of Stockholm. During the winter months, it receives almost no natural sunlight at all. It's up near the Arctic Circle. And so seasonal affectation disorder is a real problem in that city because people don't have access to sunlight during the winter months. So the city of Umeå, Sweden, has taken the existing bus stops of the city and replaced the lights that normally backlight the advertisements in bus shelters. They've replaced those lights with light therapy tubes that basically give off the good rays of the sun, in the same way that sitting in front of maybe an anti-sad lamp does. So they've replaced the commercial lighting tubes of it with light therapy tubes. While people are sitting waiting for the bus, they face these lights kind of and just soak up the good rays. An interesting thing has happened. After those light therapy tubes were installed in the bus stops, bus ridership increased by 50%. And I, to this day, I like to think that there's a whole bunch of people in the north of Sweden saying, I don't know why, but I just love taking the bus now.
But is there is obvious a causal connection? Is,
well, I mean,
I guess if it's that dramatic.
It would seem so. It would seem so.
So is this something that is kind of new, or has this been going on all through history and just in dribs and drabs?
The basic ethos of it, of course, has been going on all through history. I mean, it's actually an incredibly New England technique, you know, making do with what you have.
Right.
That's something that New Englanders are known for, you know, you just using what you have in new and inventive ways. However, so the general creative ethos underneath it has been going on for centuries. But it is definitely had an exponential increase in, say, the last 10 years for two very simple reasons. Cities are becoming denser, and there's also a finite amount of resources out there. Whether it be money, space, or material, people are realizing that the secret is to do more with what we already have.
That's the voice of Scott Burnham. The exhibit that he is overseeing at the Boston Society of Architects on Congress Street is called Reprogramming the City: Opportunities for Urban Infrastructure.
You know what I really love? Because in public spaces, there's often very few places to sit. You know, you'll have like benches somewhere.
I'm so with you on this.
There's not place to sit, and especially when you get tired, you're running around. This is a great picture. I'm not even sure where this is, but it's a big stairway. It looks like it could be behind City Hall in Boston, and the big wide stairway. And then describe what's on the side. Well, this is brilliant.
That is from Hong Kong. That is a project called The Cascade by Edge Design Institute. Hong Kong is the perfect example of what we're talking about. It is one of the world's densest cities. It's confined by its island, structures, and any development that happens in Hong Kong goes up, not out. So what they've done there, that's in central Hong Kong by a place called the Centrium, and they've taken an existing just ordinary staircase, government center staircase, is a perfect example. And what they've done is they've created this structure which attaches onto the top of the existing stairs, and it is in effect a mini city park. There's trees, there's benches, there's lighting, there's green areas. And so they've just taken a very functional stairway that people use while passing from point A to point B and turned it into essentially a plug-in park in the city. And that you'll see that.
Plug-in park.
The reaction, I'm looking at the photo. Marjorie handed me the photo. I love
it
too. Whenever I hear something like this, I don't know what to compare it to. What I'm thinking as you were speaking to Marjorie is I'm saying, what took so long? It's so obvious. As you say, when the cities get dense, they're also cost-effective. Everybody's worried about the bottom line, particularly people in positions of power who could implement these kind of changes. What was the trigger? Why isn't something this obvious, dual use for virtually everything? Why does it take so long to percolate?
I don't really know the answer to that, but What is most interesting is this exhibition that's on at BSA Space in Boston is the first of its kind. This is the first collection of all these ideas. To my knowledge, I'm really the first person, he says shamelessly.
You write a book. This should be a book, too. You write a book, I assume?
It should be a book, and I'm currently working on the book. So if there's any publishers listening.
Your man is here. So if we go down to Congress Street, we'll see at least pictures of this. We're not going to see the real things.
Oh, no. You will see many real things.
Many
there.
Real things.
One of the most, one of the greatest projects. One of the greatest projects that I'm very proud of on the ground floor space is something called Softwalks. Softwalks was created by Blandhoek and Howard Chambers in New York City. And you know the scaffolding structures, it's a very New York thing.
Yep.
They're called sidewalk sheds that sort of completely cover the sidewalks. So the scaffolding structures that you walk underneath. They've created an entire line of furniture which literally bolts onto these existing scaffolding structures. There's chairs, there's planters, there's countertops, there's lights, and we have the premiere of the Softwalks bench. All these things bolt onto the existing scaffolding of these sidewalk sheds in the city to turn these very functional, ugly structures in New York into public seating areas. Now, in Boston, why don't we use something like that and combine it with the food truck revolution the city's going through? So let's get a building site that has a whole bunch of scaffolding, pull up the food truck, just bolt on some seats, some benches. Everyone has a dining area for lunch, and it takes 10 minutes. Unbolt them, put them back in the truck, and move on to the next place.
Scott, we only have 45 seconds. Is there one company or a set of companies that is is realizing how huge the potential is here, and they're deciding to, I mean, for example, seating. Marjorie mentioned a pet peeve of mine. You can't sit anywhere in most cities. Just that, is anybody grabbing that and running with that, or is it not at that stage yet?
That's why I'm here.
Is that really so?
I want to be the person to do that. I'm meeting with a lot of people, everyone from the Fenway Alliance to other people in the city. I'm meeting with them, and I want to talk to them about the opportunity that we have here.
Can I tell you, if you don't do it fast, we're going to do it. So you better really move. Yeah. Scott Burnham, if people want
to... Jim's always saying that.
Is there a website...
He's going to shrink wrap the world.
For both this exhibit and the work you're doing, is there a
exactly.
website?
You can find my work at scottburnham.com.
It's B-U-R-N-H-A-M, correct?
Yes, okay. Yes, B-U-R-N-H-A-M, S-C-O-T-T-B-U-R-N-H-A-M, and at bsaspace.org is the Reprogramming the City website.
This is terrific. Scott, we really appreciate your time.
Thank you very much.
This is really creative and great. It's there to win. When's the exhibit there?
September 29th.
Terrific. That's Scott Burnham, and that's it for today's show, Boston Public Radio. Tomorrow on Open Mic at about 1 o'clock, we have Christopher Lydon. We're also going to go over the latest research about driving coming out of... MIT, and I assume, Marty, you'll have more news on the naming of the royal baby.
I'll
is that correct?
I'll be all over the royal baby. All the news is fit to print will be reported.
How many columns
tomorrow.
Do you think you can get out of the naming, Marjorie?
I wish I could go on indefinitely, Jim.
Part one of a three-part series. That's it for us for today. You can follow us on Twitter at BOS Public Radio, me at Jim Browdy, Marjorie at Marjorie Egan. I am Jim Browdy.
I am Marjorie Egan.
Have a great day. We'll see you tomorrow at noon. Bye.